My voice was now rising in exactly the way I wanted to avoid, but I was provoked by his attitude. Alabama case law is clear that a perjury charge can't be filed in the absence of clear and convincing evidence that a false statement has been made, I went on. A perjury indictment seems like a tactic designed to intimidate and discourage people from coming forward with evidence that contradicts the state's case. The charge against Mr. Houston seems really inappropriate, Mr. Chapman, and legally indefensible. I knew I was lecturing him and knew he didn't like it, but I wanted him to know that we were going to defend Walter in a serious way. Are you representing Darnell Houston now, too? Yes, I am. Well, I'm not sure you can do that, Mr. Stevenson. I think you might have a conflict there, he said, and then his voice shifted from argumentative to blandly matter-of-fact. But don't worry, I may drop the perjury charges against Houston. Now that the judge has denied your motion to reopen the case, I don't have any interest in pursuing charges against Darnell Houston. But I do want people to know that if they make false statements concerning this case, they are going to be held accountable. I was confused and a little stunned. What are you talking about? The motion to reconsider has been denied? Yes, the judge already denied your motion. You must not have gotten your copy of his order. He's down in Mobile now, so sometimes there are mail issues. I tried to conceal my surprise about the court's ruling on the motion without even permitting a hearing. I asked, "So you have no interest in investigating what Darnell Houston is saying about the possibility that the state's main witness may be lying?" "Ralph Myers is the state's main witness." It was clear that Chapman had looked more deeply into the case than he had initially claimed. "Without Hook's testimony, the conviction wouldn't be valid," I said, leveling my voice. "Under the state's theory, Myers is an accomplice, and state law requires confirmation of accomplice testimony, which can only come from Hook's. Mr. Houston says that Hook's is lying, which makes his testimony a critical issue that should be heard in court." I knew I was right. The law was as clear as it possibly could be on this question. But I also knew that I was talking to someone who didn't care what the law said. I knew that what I was saying wouldn't persuade Chapman, but I felt the need to say it anyway. Chapman stood up. I could tell he was annoyed by my lecturing and legal arguments, and I was pretty sure he thought I was being pushy. "That sounds like an issue you'll need to raise on appeal, Mr. Stevenson. You can tell Mr. Houston that the charges against him are being dropped. I can do that for y'all, but that's about it." His tone was dismissive, and when he turned his back to me, I knew he'd ended the meeting and was now eager to get me out of his office. I left his office extremely frustrated. Chapman had not been unfriendly or hostile, yet his indifference to McMillan's innocence claim was hard for me to accept. Reading the record had shown me that there were people who were willing to ignore evidence, logic, and common sense to convict someone and reassure the community that the crime had been solved and the murderer punished. But talking face-to-face with someone about the case made the irrational thinking swirling around Walter's conviction much, much harder to accept. Chapman hadn't prosecuted the case, and I had hoped that he might not want to defend something so unreliable. But it was clear that he was locked into this narrative just like everyone else who had been involved. I'd seen the abuse of power in many cases before, but there was something especially upsetting about it here, where not only a single defendant was being victimized, but an entire community as well. I filed my stack of motions just to make sure that if they didn't dismiss the charges, they knew we would fight them. Walking down the hallway to my car, I saw yet another flyer about the next production of To Kill a Mockingbird, which just added to my outrage. Darnell had remained home after he posted bond. I stopped by his house to discuss my meeting with the DA. He was thrilled to hear that the charges against him would be dropped, but he was still shaken by the whole experience. I explained that what the state had done to him was illegal, and that we could pursue a civil action against them, but he had no interest in that. I didn't actually think a civil suit was a good idea, since it would just leave him vulnerable to more harassment, but I didn't want him to think I was unwilling to fight on his behalf. "Mr. Stevenson, all I wanted to do is tell the truth. I can't go to jail, and I'll be honest, these folks have scared me." "I understand," I said, "but what they did is illegal, and I want you to know that you have done nothing wrong. They're the ones who have acted very, very inappropriately. They're trying to intimidate you." "Well, it's working. What I told you is true, and I stand by it, but I can't have these folks coming after me." Well, the judge has denied our motion, so you don't have to testify or come to court at this point. Let me know if you have any more problems with them or if they come to speak with you about this. You can tell people that I'm your lawyer and refer them to me, okay? Yes, okay, but does that mean you are my lawyer? Yes, I'll represent you if anyone creates any issues behind what you've disclosed. He looked a little relieved, but was still pretty rattled when I left. I got in my car with the sinking realization that if everyone who tried to help us on this case was going to be threatened, it would be very difficult to prove Walter's innocence. If his case wasn't overturned on direct appeal, we'd have a chance to file a post-conviction petition later. And we would need new evidence, new witnesses, and new facts to prove Walter's innocence. Based on the experience with Darnell, this would be extremely challenging. I decided not to worry about it now and turned my attention to the appeal. With the reconsideration denied, the appeal brief was due in 28 days. I wasn't even sure how much time had elapsed since the judge's ruling, as I'd never received the order. I left for home frustrated and worried. On my drives between Monroeville and Montgomery, I had gotten used to looking at the rural farmland, the cotton fields and the hilly countryside. I would think about what life here must have been like decades ago. This time I didn't have to imagine it. Darnell's despair, his sadness in recognizing that they could do whatever they wanted to him with impunity, was utterly disheartening. From what I could see, there simply was no commitment to the rule of law, no accountability, and little shame. Arresting someone for coming forward with credible evidence that challenged the reliability of a capital murder conviction? The more I thought about it, the more disoriented and provoked I became. It was also sobering. If they arrested people who said things that were inconvenient, how would they react if I challenged them even harder? As I left town, I watched the sunset and darkness descend across the county landscape as it had for centuries. People would be heading home now, some to very comfortable houses where they could relax easily, secure, and proud of their community. Others, people like Darnell and Walter's family, would be returning to less comfortable homes. They would not rest as easily, nor would there be much thought of community pride. For them, the darkness brought a familiar unease, an uncertainty weighted with a wary, lingering fear as old as the settlement of the county itself. Discomfort too long standing and constant to merit discussion, but too burdensome to ever forget. I drove away as quickly as I could. Chapter 6. Surely Doomed. He's just a little boy. It was late, and I had picked up the phone after hours because no one else was in the building. It was becoming a bad habit. The older woman on the other end of the line was pleading with me after offering a heartfelt description of her grandson, who had just been jailed for murder. "He's already been in the jail for 2 nights. I can't get to him. I'm in Virginia, and my health is not good. Please tell me you'll do something." I hesitated before answering her. Only a handful of countries permitted the death penalty for children, and the United States was one of them. Many of my Alabama clients were on death row for crimes they were accused of committing when they were 16 or 17-year-old children. Many states had changed their laws to make it easier to prosecute children as adults, and my clients were getting younger and younger. Alabama had more juveniles sentenced to death per capita than any other state, or any other country in the world. I was determined to manage the growing demand for our services by taking on new cases only if the client was facing execution or formally condemned to death row. This woman had told me that her grandson was only 14. While the Supreme Court had upheld the death penalty for juveniles in a 1989 ruling, a year earlier the court had barred the death penalty for children under the age of 15. Whatever perils this child faced, he was not going to be sent to death row. This lady's grandson might be facing life imprisonment without parole, but given the overwhelming number of death penalty cases on our docket, I couldn't rationalize taking on his case. As I considered how to answer this woman's plea, she started speaking quickly at a whisper. "Lord, please help us. Lead this man and protect us from any choice that is not yours. Help me find the words. Lord, tell me what to say, Lord." I didn't want to interrupt her prayer, so I waited until she finished. "Ma'am, I can't take the case, but I will drive down to the jail and see your grandson tomorrow. I'll see what I can do. We likely won't be able to represent him, but let me find out what's going on, and perhaps we can help you find a lawyer who can assist you. Mr. Stevenson, I'm so grateful." I was tired and already feeling overwhelmed with the cases I had, and cases with juveniles took an especially severe emotional toll on everyone who touched them. But I needed to go to a courthouse near the county where this boy was being held, so it wouldn't be that big a deal to stop by and see the child. The next morning I drove for over an hour to the county. When I got to the courthouse, I checked the clerk's file on the case and found a lengthy incident report. Because I was an attorney investigating the case on behalf of the family, the clerk let me read the file, although she wouldn't make a copy or let me take it out of the office because it involved a minor. The clerk's office was small, but it wasn't especially busy, so I sat down on an uncomfortable metal chair in a cramped corner of the room to read the statement, which mostly confirmed everything the grandmother had told me. Charlie was 14 years old. He weighed less than 100 pounds and was just 5 feet tall. He didn't have any juvenile criminal history, no prior arrests, no misconduct in school, no delinquencies or prior court appearances. He was a good student who had earned several certificates for perfect attendance at his school. His mother described him as a great kid who always did what she asked. But Charlie had, by his own account, shot and killed a man named George. George was Charlie's mother's boyfriend. She referred to their relationship as a mistake. George would often come home drunk and begin acting violently. There were three occasions in the year and a half leading up to the night of the shooting when George beat Charlie's mother so mercilessly that she required medical treatment. She never left George or made him leave, even though she told several people that she knew she should. On the night of the shooting, George had come home very drunk. Charlie and his mother were playing cards when he arrived. He entered the house shouting, "Hey, where are you?" Charlie's mother followed his voice to the kitchen, where she let him know that she and Charlie were home playing cards. The two adults had argued earlier in the evening because she had begged him not to go out, fearing that he would come home drunk. Now she looked at him angrily when she saw him standing there, reeking of alcohol. He looked back at her, mirroring her contempt and disgust, and in a flash, he punched her hard in the face. She didn't expect him to hit her so quickly or violently. He hadn't done it like that before. She collapsed to the floor with the crush of his blow. Charlie was standing behind his mother and saw her head slam against the metal kitchen counter as she fell. George saw Charlie standing there and glared at him coldly before brushing past him toward the bedroom, where Charlie heard him fall noisily onto the bed. Charlie's mother was lying on the floor, unconscious and bleeding badly. He knelt by his mother's side and tried to stop the bleeding. There was some blood on her face, but it poured from an ugly cut on the back of her head. Charlie tried feverishly to revive her. He started crying, futilely asking his mother what to do. He got up and put paper towels behind her head, but couldn't stop the bleeding. He frantically searched for the cloth kitchen towel because he thought that would work better, and found it wrapped around a pot on the stove. His mother had cooked black-eyed peas for dinner. He loved black-eyed peas. They'd eaten together before they'd started playing Pinochle, his favorite card game. Charlie replaced the paper towels with the cloth towel and panicked all over again when he saw how much blood there was. He was quietly begging his mother to wake up when it appeared to him that she wasn't breathing. He thought he should call an ambulance, but the phone was in the bedroom with George. George had never hit Charlie, but he terrified him just the same. As a younger child, whenever Charlie got very scared or anxious, he would sometimes start trembling and shaking. The shaking would almost always be followed by a nosebleed. Sitting on the kitchen floor with his mother's blood all around him, Charlie could feel himself starting to tremble, and within seconds the blood slowly began to trickle out of his nose. His mother would always run to get something to help him with the nosebleeds, but now she just lay on the floor. He wiped the blood from his nose and focused on the fact that he had to do something. His trembling stopped. His mother hadn't moved in nearly 15 minutes. The house was quiet. The only sound he heard was George breathing heavily in the other room. Soon he could hear him snoring. Charlie had been slowly stroking his mother's hair, desperately hoping that she would open her eyes. The blood from her head had saturated the towel and was spreading onto Charlie's pants. Charlie thought his mother might be dying or maybe even already dead. He had to call an ambulance. He stood up, flooded with anxiety, and cautiously made his way to the bedroom. Charlie saw George on the bed asleep and felt a surge of hatred for this man. He had never liked him, never understood why his mother had let him live with them. George didn't like Charlie either. He was rarely friendly to the boy. Even when he wasn't drunk, George seemed angry all the time. His mother had told Charlie that George could be sweet, but Charlie had never seen any of that. Charlie knew that George's first wife and child had been killed in a car accident, and that was why Charlie's mom said he drank so much. In the 18 months that George lived with them, it seemed to Charlie that there had been nothing but violence, loud arguments, pushing and shoving, threats, and turmoil. His mother had stopped smiling the way she used to. She'd become nervous and jumpy, and now, he thought, she's on the kitchen floor, dead. Charlie walked to the dresser against the back wall of the bedroom to reach the phone. He had called 911 a year earlier after George had hit his mom, but she had directed him to do so and told him what to say. When he reached the phone, he wasn't sure why he didn't just pick up the receiver. He could never really explain why he opened the dresser drawer instead, put his hand under the folded white t-shirts his mom had laundered, and felt for the handgun he knew George kept hidden there. He'd found it there when George had said Charlie could wear an Auburn University t-shirt someone had given him. It was way too small for George and way too big for Charlie, but he'd been grateful to have it. It had been one of George's few kind gestures. This time he didn't pull his hand back in fear as he had before. He picked up the gun. He'd never fired a gun before, but he knew he could do it. George was now snoring rhythmically. Charlie walked over to the bed, his arms stretched out, pointing the gun at George's head. As Charlie hovered over him, the snoring stopped. The room grew very, very quiet, and that's when Charlie pulled the trigger. The sound of the bullet firing was much louder than Charlie had expected. The gun jerked and pushed Charlie a step back. He almost lost his balance and fell. He looked at George and squeezed his eyes closed. It was horrible. He could feel himself starting to tremble again. And that's when he heard his mother moaning in the kitchen. He couldn't believe she was alive. He ran back to the phone and called 911, then sat next to his mother until the police arrived. After learning all of this, I was positive they would not prosecute Charlie as an adult. I continued to read the file and the notes from the initial court appearance. The prosecutor did not dispute the account that Charlie and his mother had given. It was only when I continued reading that I discovered that George was a local police officer. The prosecutor made a long argument about what a great man George had been and how upsetting his death had been for everyone in the community. George was a law enforcement officer who served with honor, the prosecutor argued. It is a great loss for the county and a tragedy that a good person could be so heartlessly killed by this young man. The prosecutor insisted that Charlie be tried as an adult, and he announced that he intended to seek the maximum punishment permitted by law. The judge agreed that this was capital murder and that the boy should be tried as an adult. Charlie was immediately taken to the county jail for adults. The small county jail was across the street from the courthouse. Like many southern communities, the courthouse anchored the square that marked the town center. I stepped outside and walked across the street to the jail to see this young man. The jailers clearly didn't receive a lot of out-of-town lawyers for legal visits. The deputy on duty looked at me suspiciously before taking me into the jail, where I sat in the small attorney meeting room waiting for Charlie. From the time I finished reading the file, I couldn't stop thinking about how tragic this case was, and my somber thoughts weren't interrupted until a small child was pushed into the visiting room. This boy seemed way too short, way too thin, and way too scared to be 14. I looked at the jailer, who seemed to share my surprise at how small and terrified the child appeared. I asked them to remove the handcuffs. Sometimes in jails like this, the guards resist uncuffing clients, arguing that it's not safe or permitted to take the handcuffs off a suspect during a legal visit. They worry that if a person gets upset or becomes violent, being uncuffed will make him or her harder to subdue. This guard didn't hesitate to take the handcuffs off this child before leaving the room. We were sitting at a wooden table that was probably 4 by 6 feet. Charlie was on one side of the table, and I was on the other. It had been 3 days since his arrest. "Charlie, my name is Brian. Your grandmother called me and asked me if I would come and see you. I'm a lawyer, and I help people who get in trouble, or who are accused of crimes, and I'd like to help you." The boy wouldn't make eye contact with me. He was tiny, but he had big, beautiful eyes. He had a close haircut that was common for little boys because it required no maintenance. It made him look even younger than he was. I thought I saw tattoos or symbols on his neck, but when I looked more closely, I realized they were bruises. "Charlie, are you okay?" He was staring intensely to my left, looking at the wall as if he saw something there. His distant look was so alarming that I actually turned to see if there was something of interest behind me, but it was just a blank wall. The disconnected look, the sadness in his face, and his complete lack of engagement, qualities he shared with a lot of other teenagers I'd worked with, were the only things that made me believe he was 14. I sat and waited for a very long time in the hope that he would give me some kind of response, but the room remained silent. He stared at the wall and then looked down at his own wrists. He wrapped his right hand around his left wrist where the handcuffs had been and rubbed the spot where the metal had pinched him. "Charlie, I want to make sure you're doing okay, so I just need you to answer a few questions for me, okay?" I knew he could hear me. Whenever I spoke, he would lift his head and return his gaze to the spot on the wall. "Charlie, if I were you, I'd be pretty scared and really worried right now, but I'd also want someone to help me. I'd like to help, okay?" I waited for a response, but none was forthcoming. "Charlie, can you speak? Are you okay?" He stared at the wall when I spoke and then back at his wrists when I was finished, but he didn't say a word. "We don't have to talk about George. We don't have to talk about what happened. We can talk about whatever you want. Is there something you want to talk about?" I was waiting for longer and longer stretches after each question, desperately hoping that he would say something, but he didn't. "Do you want to talk about your mom? She's going to be fine, I've checked, and even though she can't visit you, she's going to be fine. She's worried about you." I thought talking about his mother would spark something in Charlie's eyes. When it didn't, I became even more concerned about the child. I noticed that there was a second chair on Charlie's side of the table, and I realized that lawyers were apparently supposed to sit on that side and the clients on the side I chose, where there was only one chair. I'd sat in the wrong place. I lowered my voice and spoke more softly. "Charlie, you've got to talk to me. I can't help you if you don't. Would you just say your name? Say something, please." He continued to stare at the wall. I waited and then stood up and walked around the table. He didn't look at me as I moved, but returned his gaze to his wrist. I sat in the chair next to him, leaned close, and said quietly, "Charlie, I'm really sorry if you're upset, but please talk to me. I can't help you if you don't talk to me." He leaned back in his chair for the first time, nearly placing his head on the wall behind us. I pulled my chair closer to him and leaned back in mine. We sat silently for a long time, and then I started saying silly things because I didn't know what else to do. "Well, you won't tell me what you're thinking, so I guess I'm going to just have to tell you what I'm thinking. I bet you think you know what I'm thinking," I said playfully. "But in fact, you really couldn't possibly imagine. You probably think I'm thinking about the law or the judge or the police or why won't this young man speak with me? But what I'm actually thinking about is food. Yes, that's right, Charlie," I continued teasingly. "I'm thinking about fried chicken and collard greens cooked with turkey meat and sweet potato biscuits. You ever had a sweet potato biscuit?" "Nothing." "You've probably never had a sweet potato biscuit, and that's a shame." Still nothing. I kept going. "I'm thinking about getting a new car because my car is so old. I waited. Nothing. Charlie, you're supposed to say, how old is it, Brian? And then I say, my car is so old. He never smiled or responded. He just continued looking at the spot on the wall, his face frozen in sadness. What kind of car do you think I should get? I went through a range of ridiculous musings that yielded nothing from Charlie. He continued to lean back and his body seemed a little less tense. I noticed that our shoulders were now touching. After a while, I tried again. Come on, Charlie. What's going on? You've got to talk to me, son. I started leaning on him somewhat playfully until he sat forward a bit, and then I finally felt him lean back into me. I took a chance and put my arm around him, and he immediately began to shake. His trembling intensified before he finally leaned completely into me and started crying. I put my head to his and said, "It's okay. It's all right." He was sobbing when he finally spoke. It didn't take me long to realize that he wasn't talking about what happened with George or with his mom, but about what happened at the jail. There were three men who hurt me on the first night. They touched me and made me do things. Tears were streaming down his face. His voice was high-pitched and strained with anguish. They came back the next night and hurt me a lot, he said, becoming more hysterical with each word. Then he looked in my face for the first time. There were so many last night, I don't know how many there were, but they hurt me. He was crying too hard to finish his sentence. He gripped my jacket with a force I wouldn't have imagined he was capable of exerting. I held him, and I told him as gently as I could, "It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay." I'd never held anyone who gripped me as tightly as that child or cried as hard or as long. It seemed like his tears would never end. He would tire and then start again. I just decided to hold him until he stopped. It was almost an hour before he calmed down and the crying stopped. I promised him that I would try to get him out of there right away. He begged me not to leave, but I assured him that I would be back that day. We never talked about the crime. When I left the jail, I was more angry than sad. I kept asking myself, who is responsible for this? How could we ever allow this? I went directly to the sheriff's office inside the jail and explained to the overweight, middle-aged sheriff what the child had told me, and I insisted that they immediately place him in a protected single cell. The sheriff listened with a distracted look on his face, but when I said I was going to see the judge, he agreed to move the child into a protected area immediately. I then went back across the street to the courthouse and found the judge, who called the prosecutor. When the prosecutor arrived in the judge's chambers, I told them that the child had been sexually abused and raped. They agreed to move him to a nearby juvenile facility within the next several hours. I decided to take on the case. We ultimately got Charlie's case transferred to juvenile court, where the shooting was adjudicated as a juvenile offense. That meant Charlie wouldn't be sent to an adult prison, and he would likely be released before he turned 18, in just a few years. I visited Charlie regularly, and in time he recovered. He was a smart, sensitive child who was tormented by what he'd done and what he'd been through. At a talk I gave at a church months later, I spoke about Charlie and the plight of incarcerated children. Afterward, an older married couple approached me and insisted that they had to help Charlie. I tried to dissuade these kind people from thinking that they could do anything, but I gave them my card and told them that they could call me. I didn't expect to hear from them, but within days they called and they were persistent. We eventually agreed that they would write a letter to Charlie and send it to me to pass on to him. When I received the letter weeks later, I read it. It was remarkable. Mr. and Mrs. Jennings were a white couple in their mid-70s from a small community northeast of Birmingham. They were kind and generous people who were active in their local United Methodist Church. They never missed a Sunday service and were especially drawn to children in crisis. They spoke softly and always seemed to be smiling, but never appeared to be anything less than completely genuine and compassionate. They were affectionate with each other in a way that was endearing, frequently holding hands and leaning into each other. They dressed like farmers and owned 10 acres of land where they grew vegetables and lived simply. Their one and only grandchild, whom they had helped raise, had committed suicide when he was a teenager, and they had never stopped grieving for him. Their grandson struggled with mental health problems during his short life, but he was a smart kid and they had been putting money away to send him to college. They explained in their letter that they wanted to use the money they had saved for their grandson to help Charlie. Eventually, Charlie and this couple began corresponding with one another, building up to the day when the Jennings met Charlie at the juvenile detention facility. They later told me that they loved him instantly. Charlie's grandmother had died a few months after she first called me, and his mother was still struggling after the tragedy of the shooting and Charlie's incarceration. Charlie had been apprehensive about meeting the Jennings because he thought they wouldn't like him, but he told me after they left how much they seemed to care about him and how comforting that was. The Jennings became his family. At one point early on, I tried to caution them against expecting too much from Charlie after his release. "You know, he's been through a lot. I'm not sure he can just carry on as if nothing ever happened. I want you to understand he may not be able to do everything you'd like him to do." They never accepted my warnings. Mrs. Jennings was rarely disagreeable or argumentative, but I had learned that she would grunt when someone said something she didn't completely accept. She told me, "We've all been through a lot, Brian, all of us. I know that some have been through more than others. But if we don't expect more from each other, hope better for one another, and recover from the hurt we experience, we are surely doomed." The Jennings helped Charlie get his general equivalency degree in detention and insisted on financing his college education. They were there, along with his mother, to take him home when he was released. Chapter 7. Justice Denied. Walter's appeal was denied. The 70-page opinion from the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals affirming his conviction and death sentence was devastating. I'd filed a lengthy brief that documented the insufficiency of the evidence and raised every legal deficiency in the trial that I could identify. I argued that there was no credible corroboration of Myers' testimony, and that under Alabama law, the state couldn't rely exclusively on the testimony of an accomplice. I argued that there was prosecutorial misconduct, racially discriminatory jury selection, and an improper change of venue. I even challenged Judge Robert E. Lee Key's override of the jury's life sentence, though I knew the reduction of an innocent man's death sentence to life imprisonment without parole would still have been an egregious miscarriage of justice. The court rejected all of my arguments. I didn't think it would turn out this way. At the oral argument months earlier, I'd been hopeful as I walked into the imposing Alabama Judicial Building and stood in the grand appellate courtroom that was formerly a Scottish Rite Freemasonry temple. Constructed in the 1920s, the building was renovated into a cavernous courthouse in the 1940s, complete with marble floors and an impressive dome ceiling. It stood at the end of Dexter Avenue in Montgomery, across the street from the historic Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had pastored during the Montgomery bus boycott. A block away was the state capitol, adorned with three banners: the American flag, the white and red state flag of Alabama, and the battle flag of the Confederacy. The Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals courtroom was on the second floor. The chief judge of the court was former Governor John Patterson. He had made national news in the 1960s as a fierce opponent of civil rights and racial integration. In 1958, with the backing of the Ku Klux Klan, he defeated George Wallace for governor. His positions were even more pro-segregation than Wallace's, who, having learned his lesson, would become the most famous segregationist in America, declaring in 1963, "Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever," just a block away from this courthouse. When he was attorney general before becoming governor, Patterson banned the NAACP from operating in Alabama and blocked civil rights boycotts and protests in Tuskegee and Montgomery. As governor, he withheld law enforcement protection for the Freedom Riders, the black and white college students and activists who traveled south in the early 1960s to desegregate public facilities in recognition of new federal laws. When the Freedom Riders bus traveled through Alabama, they were abandoned by the police. Alone and unprotected, they were beaten violently, and their bus was bombed. Still, I forced myself to be hopeful. That was all long ago. During my argument, the court's five judges looked at me with curiosity, but asked few questions. I chose to interpret their silence as agreement. I hoped they saw so little support for the conviction that they didn't think there was much to discuss. Judge Patterson's only remark during the oral argument came at the end, when he slowly but firmly asked a single question that echoed through the mostly empty courtroom. "Where are you from?" I was thrown by the question and hesitated before answering. "I live in Montgomery, sir." I had foolishly discouraged McMillan's family from attending the oral argument because I knew that the issues were fairly arcane and that there would be very little discussion of the facts. Supporters would have to take off from work and make the long drive to Montgomery for an early morning argument. Since each side had only 30 minutes to present, I hadn't thought it worth the effort. When I sat down after the argument, I regretted that decision. I would have appreciated some sympathetic faces in the courtroom to signal to the court that this case was different, but there were none. An assistant attorney general then presented the state's arguments. Capital cases on appeal were managed by the attorney general, not the local district attorney. The state's lawyer argued that this was a routine capital murder case and that the death penalty had been appropriately imposed. Following the oral argument, I still had hope that the court would overturn the conviction and sentence because it was so clearly unsupported by reliable facts. State law required credible corroboration of accomplice testimony in a murder case, and there simply wasn't any in Walter's case. I believed that the court would have a hard time affirming a conviction with so little evidence. I was wrong. I drove to the prison to deliver the news. Walter didn't say anything as I explained the situation, but he had a strange, despairing look on his face. I had tried to prepare him for the possibility that it could take years to get his conviction overturned, but he had gotten his hopes up. "They aren't ever going to admit they made a mistake," he said glumly. "They know I didn't do this. They just can't admit to being wrong, to looking bad." "We're just getting started, Walter," I replied. "There's a lot more to do, and we're going to make them confront this." I was telling the truth. We did have to press on. Our plan was to ask the Court of Criminal Appeals to reconsider its decision, and if that turned out to be a dead end, we would seek review in the Alabama Supreme Court. And we had uncovered even more evidence of Walter's innocence. After filing the appeal brief, I'd continued investigating the case intensively. If we hadn't come up with so much new evidence to prove Walter's innocence, I think the court's ruling would have been even more overwhelming. I told Walter before I left the prison, "They don't know what we now know about your innocence. As soon as we present the new evidence to them, they'll think differently." My hopefulness was genuine, in spite of everything that had happened already, but I was underestimating the resistance we would face. I'd finally been able to hire some additional lawyers for the organization, which gave me more time to investigate Walter's case. One of my new hires was Michael O'Connor, a recent Yale Law School graduate with a passion for helping people in trouble that had been kindled by his own struggles earlier in life. The son of Irish immigrants, Michael had grown up outside of Philadelphia in a tough working-class neighborhood. When his high school friends started experimenting with hard drugs, so did Mike, and he soon developed a heroin addiction. His life descended into a nightmare of drug dependency and chaos, complete with the growing risk of death by overdose. For several years, he floated from one crisis to another until the overdose death of a close friend motivated him to crawl his way back to sobriety. Throughout all of this heartache, his family had never abandoned him. They helped him stabilize his life and find his way back to college. At Penn State, he revealed himself to be a brilliant student, graduating summa cum laude. His academic credentials got him into Yale Law School, but his heart was still connected to all the brokenness his years on the street had shown him. When I interviewed him for the job, he was apologetic about the darker episodes in his past, but I thought he was perfect for the kind of staff we were trying to build. He signed up, moved to Montgomery, and without hesitation jumped into the McMillan case with me. We spent days tracking leads, interviewing dozens of people, following wild rumors, investigating different theories. I was increasingly persuaded that we would have to figure out who really had killed Rhonda Morrison to win Walter's release. Aside from my appreciation for Michael's invaluable help with the work itself, I was grateful finally to have someone around to share the insanity of the case with, just as I was discovering that it was even crazier than I thought. After a few months of investigation, we'd uncovered strong evidence to support Walter's innocence. We discovered that Bill Hooks had been paid by Sheriff Tate for his testimony against Walter. We found checks in the county's financial records showing close to $5,000 in payments to Hooks in reward money and expenses. Sheriff Tate had also paid Hooks money to travel back and forth out of the county around the time of the trial. This information should have been disclosed to Walter's counsel prior to trial so that they could have used it to cast doubt on the credibility of Hooks' testimony. We also found out that Hooks had been released from jail immediately after giving the police his statement that he'd seen Walter's lowrider truck at the cleaners on the day of the murder. We found court records revealing that the DA and the sheriff, who are county officials, had somehow gotten city charges and fines against Hooks dismissed, even though they had no authority in city courts. Under U.S. Supreme Court precedent, that Hooks had charges against him dismissed in exchange for cooperation with authorities was information that the state was obligated to reveal to the defense. But of course they hadn't. We found the white man who was running the store on the day that Ralph Myers came in for the purpose of giving a note to Walter. Walter had tried to persuade his original lawyers to speak to this man, but they had failed to do so. After Walter described the location of the store, we were able to track him down. The store owner recounted his memory of that day. Myers had sought out Walter, but had to ask the store owner which of the several black men in the store was Walter McMillan. Months after the crime, the store owner was adamant that Myers had never seen Walter McMillan before. In a church basement, Walter's sister found flyers advertising the fish fry held at Walter's house. They confirmed that the event had taken place on the same day as the Morrison murder. A white store owner who had no relationship to Walter or his family had kept a copy of that flyer for some reason, and he confirmed that he had received it before the Morrison murder. We even tracked down Clay Cast, the white mechanic who had modified Walter's truck and converted it to a lowrider. He confirmed that the work had been done over 6 months after Rhonda Morrison was murdered. This proved that McMillan's truck had no modifications or special features and therefore could not have been the truck described by Myers and Hooks at the trial. I was feeling very good about the progress we were making when I got a call that would become the most significant break in the case. The voice said, "Mr. Stevenson, this is Ralph Myers." Our secretary had told me there was a Mr. Miles on the phone, so I was a little shocked to hear Ralph Myers on the other end of the line. Before I could compose myself, he spoke again. "I think you need to come and see me. I have something I need to tell you," he said dramatically. Myers was imprisoned at the St. Clair Correctional Facility in Springville, Alabama, and Michael and I made plans to meet him there in 3 days. Michael and I had started running a few miles at night after work to help us wind down from the increasingly long work days. Montgomery has a beautiful park that houses the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, which brings nationally acclaimed playwrights and actors to Alabama to perform Shakespeare and modern theatrical productions. The theater is set among hundreds of acres of beautifully maintained parkland with lakes and ponds. There are several trails for running. That evening we spent most of our run speculating about what Myers would tell us. "Why would Myers call us now?" Michael asked. "Can you imagine just going into a courtroom and straight up making up a story that puts an innocent man on death row? I'm not sure we can trust anything he says." "Well, you may be right, but he had a lot of help in putting together that testimony. Remember, they also put Myers on death row to coerce some of those statements. Who knows? He may be in touch with the state now, and this is some kind of setup where they are trying to mislead us." I hadn't seriously considered that possibility until our run that night. I thought again about how sleazy Myers had been during the trial. "We have to be careful to not reveal information to Myers, just get information he has. But we have to talk to him because if he recants his trial testimony, the state has nothing on Walter." We agreed that depending on what he had to say, Myers could change everything for us. We had made a lot of progress in disproving the testimony of Bill Hooks, with the appearance of Darnell Houston, the new evidence about the condition of Walter's truck, and the discovery of the assistance given Hooks by law enforcement. His testimony was now riddled with credibility issues. But getting a recantation from Myers would be a much bigger deal. Myers' bizarre accusations and testimony were the basis of the state's entire case. Having read Meyer's testimony and reviewed the records that were available about him, I knew that he had a tragic background and a complex personality. Walter and his family had described Myers as pure evil for the lies he had told during the trial. The experience of being so coldly lied about at trial by someone you don't even know was one of the most disquieting parts of the trial for Walter. When Walter called me at the office the next day, I told him that we'd heard from Myers and that we were going to see what he had to say. Walter warned me, "He's a snake. Be careful." Michael and I drove 2 hours to the state prison in Springville, in St. Clair County. The prison is in a rural area northeast of Birmingham, where the Alabama terrain starts to turn rocky and mountainous. The maximum security prison was more recently built than Holman or Donaldson, the other maximum security prisons in Alabama, but no one would suggest that St. Clair was modern. Michael and I cleared security at the prison entrance. The guard who patted us down said he'd been working at the prison for 3 months, and this was the first time he'd had a legal visit during his shift. We were directed down a long corridor that led to a flight of stairs that took us deeper inside the prison. We were admitted through several secure metal doors into the large room that served as the visitation area. It was typical. There were vending machines against the back walls, and small rectangular tables where inmates could meet with family members. The familiarity of the setting did little to calm us. Michael and I put our notepads and pens on one of the tables and then paced around the room, waiting for Myers. When Myers walked into the visitation area, I was surprised at how old he seemed. His hair was almost completely gray, which made him seem frail and vulnerable. He was also shorter, with a much smaller body frame than I was expecting. His testimony had caused so much anguish for Walter and his family that I had created a larger-than-life image of him. He walked toward us but stopped short when he saw Michael and nervously blurted out, "Who is he? You didn't tell me you were bringing anybody with you." Myers had a thick southern accent. Up close, his scars made him appear more sympathetic than menacing or villainous. "This is Michael O'Connor. He's a lawyer in my office, working with me on this case. Michael is just helping me investigate this case." "Well, people told me I could trust you. I don't know anything about him." "I promise he's fine." I glanced over at Michael, who was trying his best to look trustworthy, before turning back to Myers. "Please, have a seat." He looked at Michael skeptically and then slowly sat down. My plan was to try to ease him into the conversation by letting him know that we just wanted the truth. But before I could say anything, Myers blurted out a full recantation of his trial testimony. "I lied. Everything I said at McMillan's trial was a lie. I've lost a lot of sleep and have been in a lot of pain over this. I can't be quiet any longer." "The testimony you gave at trial against Walter McMillan was a lie?" I asked cautiously. My heart was pounding, but I tried to stay as steady as I could. I was afraid that if I seemed too eager or too surprised, too anything, he might retreat. "It was all a lie. What I'm going to tell you is going to blow your mind, Mr. Stevenson." He held his stare on me dramatically before turning to Michael. "You too, Jimmy Connors." It didn't take many conversations with Ralph before it became clear that he had difficulty remembering names. "Mr. Myers, you know I'm going to want you to not only tell me the truth, but also tell the court the truth. Are you willing to do that?" I was nervous to push so quickly, but I needed to be clear. I didn't want a private performance. "That's why I called you." He sounded surprised that there could be any question about his intentions. "I've been in group therapy class here. You're supposed to be real honest. We've been talking about honesty for nearly 3 months. Last week, people were talking about all the bad shit that happened to them when they were kids and all the bad things they'd done." Myers was picking up steam as he spoke. "I finally told the group, 'Well, I can top all you sons of bitches. I done put a damn man on death row by lying in damn court.'" He paused dramatically. "After I told them all what I'd done, everybody said I needed to make it right. That's what I'm trying to do." He paused again to let me take it all in. "Hey, y'all gonna buy me a damn soda, or am I just gonna sit here all day looking at them damn vending machines and pouring my heart out?" He smiled for the first time since we'd been together. Michael jumped up and walked over to buy him a drink. "Hey, Jimmy, sun-kissed orange if they got it." For more than 2 hours, I asked questions and Ralph gave answers. By the end, he did, in fact, blow my mind. He told us about being pressured by the sheriff and the ABI and threatened with the death penalty if he didn't testify against McMillan. He made accusations of official corruption, talked about his involvement in the Pittman murder, and revealed his earlier attempts to recant. He ultimately admitted that he had never known anything about the Morrison murder, had no clue what had happened to her or anything else at all about that crime. He said that he had told lots of people, from the DA on down, that he had been coerced to testify falsely against Walter. If even half of what he said was true, there were a lot of people involved in this case who knew, from the mouth of his sole accuser, that Walter McMillan had nothing to do with the murder of Rhonda Morrison. Ralph was on his third sun-kissed orange when he stopped his stream of confessions, leaned forward, and beckoned us closer. He spoke in a whisper to Michael and me. "You know, they'll try to kill you if you actually get to the bottom of everything." We would learn that Ralph could never let a meeting end without dropping some final dramatic insight, observation, or prediction. I reassured him that we would be careful. On the drive back to Montgomery, Michael and I debated how much we could trust Myers. What he told us about the McMillan case all made sense. His story at trial was so implausible that it was easy to believe that he had been pressured to testify falsely. The corruption narrative that he seemed intent to expose was harder to assess. Myers claimed to have committed the Vicki Pittman murder under the direction of another local sheriff. He laid out to us a widespread conspiracy involving police, drug dealing, and money laundering. It was quite a tale. We spent weeks following up on the leads that Myers had provided. He admitted to us that he had never met Walter and only knew of him through Karen Kelly. He also confirmed that he had been spending time with Karen Kelly and that she was involved in the Pittman murder. So we decided to confirm the story with Kelly herself, now a prisoner at the Tutwiler Prison for Women, where she was serving a 10-year sentence for the Pittman murder. Tutwiler is one of the state's oldest prisons and the only prison in the state for women. It has fewer security restrictions than the men's prisons. When Michael and I drove up to the gate, we could see incarcerated women hovering outside the prison entrance with no officers in view. The women eyed Michael and me carefully before greeting us with curious smiles. We were subjected to a very cursory pat-down in the prison lobby by a male officer before being admitted through the barred gate to the main prison area. We were told to wait for Karen Kelly in a very small room that was empty except for a square table. Kelly was a slender white woman in her mid-30s who walked into the room wearing no restraints or handcuffs. She seemed surprisingly comfortable, shaking my hand confidently before nodding at Michael. She was wearing makeup, including a garish shade of green eyeshadow. She sat down and announced that Walter had been framed and that she was grateful finally to be able to tell someone. When we began with our questions, she quickly confirmed that Myers had not known Walter before the Morrison murder. "Ralph is a fool. He thought he could trust those crooked cops, and he let them talk him into saying he was involved with a crime he didn't know anything about. He's done enough bad that he didn't need to go around making stuff up." Though she was calm at the outset of our interview, she became increasingly emotional as she started detailing the events surrounding the case. She wept more than once. She spoke with remorse about how her life had spiraled out of control when she started abusing drugs. "I'm not a bad person, but I've made some really foolish, bad decisions." She was especially upset that Walter was on death row. "I feel like I'm the reason that he's in prison. He's just not the kind of person that would kill somebody. I know that." Then her tone turned bitter. "I made a lot of mistakes, but those people should be ashamed. They've done just as much bad as I've done. Sheriff Tate only had one thing on his mind. He just kept saying, 'Why you want to sleep with niggers? Why you want to sleep with niggers?' It was awful, and he's awful." She paused and looked down at her hands. "But I'm awful, too. Look at what I've done," she said sadly. I began getting letters from Karen Kelly after our visit. She wanted me to tell Walter how sorry she was about what had happened to him. She said she still cared about him a great deal. It wasn't clear what we could expect from Karen if we got a new hearing in court, other than to confirm that Ralph had never met Walter. It was clear that she saw Walter as the kind of person who would never kill someone violently, which was consistent with the opinion of everyone who knew him. She hadn't dealt with the police much around the Morrison murder and didn't have useful information pointing to their misconduct, aside from being able to show how they were provoked by her relationship with Walter. Michael and I decided to spend more time looking into the Pittman murder. We thought it might give us some perspective on the coercion that was leveled against Myers. We now knew that because Myers had recanted his accusations against Walter before the trial, the state might not be entirely surprised to hear that he was denying McMillan's involvement in the crime. We needed as much objective evidence as we could find to confirm the truth of what Myers was now saying. Understanding the Pittman case and documenting the other demonstrably false things Myers had asserted would strengthen our evidence. Vicki Pittman's murder had been all but forgotten. Monroe County officials had reduced Myers and Kelly's sentences in exchange for Myers' testimony against Walter. How they managed to reduce sentences in the Pittman case, which was outside their jurisdiction in another county, was another anomaly. Myers insisted that there were other people besides him and Kelly involved in the Pittman murder, including a corrupt local sheriff. There were still questions about why Vicki Pittman had been killed. Myers told us that her murder had everything to do with drug debts and threats she had made to expose corruption. We had learned from some of the early police reports that the father of Vicki Pittman, Vic Pittman, had been implicated as a suspect in her death. Vicki Pittman had two aunts, Moselle and Anzel, who had been collecting information and desperately seeking answers to the questions surrounding their niece's death. We reached out to them on the off chance that they'd be willing to speak with us, and we were astounded when they eagerly agreed to talk. Moselle and Anzel were twin sisters. They were also colorful, opinionated talkers who could be bracingly direct. The two middle-aged, rural white women spent so much time together that they could finish each other's sentences without even seeming to notice. They described themselves as country tough and presented themselves as fearless, relentless women who could not be intimidated. "Just so you know, we're gun owners, so don't bring no drama when you come." This was Moselle's last warning before I hung up the phone with her the first time we talked. Michael and I traveled to rural Escambia County and were greeted by the twins. They invited us in, sat us at the kitchen table, and wasted no time. "Did your client kill our baby?" Moselle asked bluntly. "No, ma'am, I sincerely believe he did not." "Do you know who did?" I sighed. "Well, not completely. We've spoken to Ralph Myers and believe that he and Karen Kelly were involved, but Myers insists that there were others involved as well." Moselle looked at Anzel and leaned back. "We know there's more involved," said Anzel. The sisters voiced suspicions about their brother and about local law enforcement, but complained that the prosecutor had disrespected and ignored them. Vic Pittman was never formally charged for the murder. They said they were turned away even by the state's victims' rights group. "They treated us like we were low-class white trash. They could not have cared less about us." Moselle looked furious as she spoke. "I thought they treated victims better. I thought we had some say." Although crime victims had long complained about their treatment in the criminal justice system, by the 1980s a new movement had emerged that resulted in much more responsiveness to the perspective of crime victims and their families. The problem was that not all crime victims received the same treatment. 50 years ago, the prevailing concept in the American criminal justice system was that everyone in the community is the victim when an offender commits a violent crime. The party that prosecutes a criminal defendant is the state, or the people, or the Commonwealth, because when someone is murdered, raped, robbed, or assaulted, it is an offense against all of us. In the early 1980s, though, states started involving individual crime victims in the trial process and began personalizing crime victims in their presentation of cases. Some states authorized the family members of the victim to sit at the prosecutor's table during trial. 36 states enacted laws that gave victims specific rights to participate in the trial process or to make victim impact statements. In many places, prosecutors started introducing themselves as the lawyer representing a particular victim, rather than as a representative of the civic authorities. In death penalty cases, the U.S. Supreme Court said in 1987 that introducing evidence about the status, character, reputation, or family of a homicide victim was unconstitutional. The prevailing idea for decades had been that all victims are equal. That is, the murder of a 4-year-old child of a wealthy parent is no more serious an offense than the murder of a child whose parent is in prison, or even than the murder of the parent in prison. The court prohibited jurors from hearing victim impact statements because they were too inflammatory and introduced arbitrariness into the capital sentencing process. Many critics argued that such evidence would ultimately disempower poor victims, victims who were racial minorities and family members who didn't have the resources to advocate for their deceased loved ones. The court agreed, striking down this kind of evidence in Booth v. Maryland. The court's decision was widely criticized by prosecutors and some politicians, and it seemed to energize the victims' rights movement. Less than 3 years later, the court reversed itself in Payne v. Tennessee and upheld the rights of states to present evidence about the character of the victim in a capital sentencing trial. With the Supreme Court now giving its constitutional blessing to a more visible and protected role for individual victims in the criminal trial process, changes in the American criminal justice process accelerated. Millions of state and federal dollars were authorized to create advocacy groups for crime victims in each state. States found countless ways for individual victims in particular crimes to become decision makers and participants. Victims' advocates were added to parole boards, and in most states, they were given a formal role in state and local prosecutors' offices. Victim services and outreach became critical components of the prosecutorial function. Some states made executions more accommodating of victims by increasing the number of people from the victim's family who could watch the execution. State legislatures enacted harsh new punishments for crimes, naming statutes after particular victims. Megan's Law, for example, which broadened state power to create sex offender registries, was named after Megan Kanka, a 7-year-old girl who was raped and murdered by a man who had been previously convicted of child molestation. Instead of a faceless state or community, crime victims were featured at trial, and criminal cases took on the dynamics of a traditional civil trial, pitting the family of the victim against the offender. Press coverage hyped the personal nature of the conflict between the offender and specific victim. A new formula emerged for criminal prosecution, especially in high-profile cases, in which the emotions, perspectives, and opinions of the victim figured prominently in how criminal cases would be managed. However, as Mozell and Unzel discovered, focusing on the status of the victim became one more way for the criminal justice system to disfavor some people. Poor and minority victims of crime experienced additional victimization by the system itself. The Supreme Court's decision in Payne appeared shortly after the court's decision in McCleskey v. Kemp, a case that presented convincing empirical evidence that the race of the victim is the greatest predictor of who gets the death penalty in the United States. The study conducted for that case revealed that offenders in Georgia were 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim was white than if the victim was black. These findings were replicated in every other state where studies about race and the death penalty took place. In Alabama, even though 65% of all homicide victims were black, nearly 80% of the people on death row were there for crimes against victims who were white. Black defendant and white victim pairings increased the likelihood of a death sentence even more. Many poor and minority victims complained that they were not getting calls or support from local police and prosecutors. Many weren't included in the conversations about whether a plea bargain was acceptable or what sentence was appropriate. If your family had lost a loved one to murder or had to suffer the anguish of rape or serious assault, your victimization might be ignored if you had loved ones who were incarcerated. The expansion of victims' rights ultimately made formal what had always been true. Some victims are more protected and valued than others. More than anything else, it was the lack of concern and responsiveness by police, prosecutors, and victim services providers that devastated Mozell and Unzel. "You're the first two people to come to our house and spend time with us talking about Vicky," Unzel told us. After nearly 3 hours of hearing their heartbreaking reflections, we promised to do what we could to find out who else was involved in their niece Vicky's death. We were getting to the point where, without access to police records and files, we wouldn't be able to make more progress. Because the case was now pending on direct appeal, the state had no obligation to let us see those records and files, so we decided to file what is known as a Rule 32 petition, which would put us back in a trial court with the opportunity to present new evidence and obtain discovery, including access to the state's files. Rule 32 petitions are required to include claims that were not raised at trial or on appeal, and that could not have been raised at trial or on appeal. They are the vehicle to challenge a conviction based on ineffective counsel, the state's failure to disclose evidence, and most important, new evidence of innocence. Michael and I put a petition together that asserted all of these claims, including police and prosecutorial misconduct, and filed it in the Monroe County Circuit Court. The document, which alleged that Walter McMillan was unfairly tried, wrongly convicted, and illegally sentenced, drew a lot of attention in Monroeville. 3 years had passed since the trial. The initial confirmation of Walter's conviction on appeal had generated significant press in the community, and most people now felt that Walter's guilt was a settled matter. All there was left to do was wait for an execution date. Judge Key had retired, and none of the new Monroe County judges seemed to want to touch our petition, so it was transferred back to Baldwin County under the theory that the post-conviction appeal should be handled in the same county as the initial trial. This made little sense to us because a Monroe County judge had presided over the trial, but there was nothing we could do. Surprisingly, the Alabama Supreme Court agreed to stay our direct appeal process so that the Rule 32 petition could proceed. The general rule was that the direct appeal had to be completed before a post-conviction collateral appeal under Rule 32 could be initiated. By staying the case, the Alabama Supreme Court had signaled there was something unusual about Walter's case that warranted further review in the lower courts. The Baldwin County Circuit Judge was now obligated to review our case and could be forced to grant our discovery motions, which would require disclosure of all police and prosecutorial files. This was a very positive development. We needed to have another meeting with the district attorney, Tommy Chapman, but this time we'd be going in armed with a court order to turn over police and prosecutorial files. We would also finally meet, in the flesh, the law enforcement officers involved in Walter's prosecution. The DA's investigator, Larry Eichner, ABI agent Simon Benson, and Sheriff Tom Tate. Chapman suggested that we come to his office in the Monroe County Courthouse so that they could turn over all their files together. We agreed. When we arrived, the men were already there. Tate was a tall, heavy-set white man who had come to the meeting in boots, jeans, and a light shirt. Eichner was another white man in his mid-40s wearing the same outfit. Neither of them smiled much. They greeted Michael and me with the bemused curiosity to which I was getting accustomed. The men knew that we were accusing them of misconduct, but for the most part they remained civil. At one point, Tate told Michael that he knew, as soon as he saw him, that he was a Yankee. Michael smiled and replied, "Well, actually, I'm a Nittany Lion." The joke died in the silent room. Undeterred, Michael continued, "I went to Penn State. The mascot at Penn State is, 'We kicked your ass in 78. Tate made the statement as if he just won the lottery. Penn State and the University of Alabama had been football rivals in the 1970s, when both schools had had successful programs and iconic coaches, Bear Bryant at Alabama and Joe Paterno at Penn State. Alabama had defeated the number one ranked Penn State team 14-7 to win the 1978 national championship. Michael, a huge college football fan and Joe Pa devotee, looked at me as if seeking nonverbal permission to say something reckless. I gave him a cautionary stare. To my great relief, he seemed to understand. "How much is Johnny D paying y'all?" Tate asked, using the nickname Walter's friends and family had given him. "We work for a nonprofit. We don't charge the people we represent anything," I said as blandly and politely as I could. "Well, you're getting money from somewhere to do what you do." I decided to let that pass and move things forward. I thought that it might be a good idea to sign something that verifies that these are all the files you all have on this case. Can we index what you're turning over to us and then all sign? We don't need to do anything that formal, Brian. These men are officers of the court, just like you and I. You should just take the files, Chapman said, apparently sensing that this suggestion had provoked Tate and Eichner. Well, there could be files that have inadvertently been missed, or documents that dropped out. I'm just trying to document that what we receive is what you give us, same number of pages, same file folder headings, etc. I'm not questioning anyone's integrity. The hell you ain't, Tate was direct. He looked at Chapman. We can sign something confirming what we give him. I think we may need a record of that more than he does. Chapman nodded. We got the files and left Monroeville with a lot of excitement about what we might find in the hundreds of pages of records we'd received. Back in Montgomery, we eagerly started reviewing them, and not just the files from the police and prosecutors. With our discovery order from the court, we were able to collect records from Taylor Hardin, the mental health facility where Myers was sent after he first refused to testify. We got the ABI file from Simon Benson, the only black ABI agent in South Alabama, as he had proudly told us. We got Monroeville City Police Department records and other city files. We even got Escambia County records and exhibits on the Vicki Pittman murder. The files were astonishing. We might have been influenced by the pain of Moselle and Anzell, or drawn in by the elaborate conspiracies that Ralph Myers had described. But we soon started asking questions about some of the law enforcement officers whose names kept coming up around the Pittman murder. We even decided to talk to the FBI about some of what we had learned. It wasn't long after that when the bomb threat started. Chapter 8. All God's Children. Uncried Tears, a poem by Ian Manuel at the Union Correctional Institution. Imagine teardrops left uncried, from pain trapped inside, waiting to escape through the windows of your eyes. Why won't you let us out? The tears question the conscience. Relinquish your fears and doubts, and heal yourself in the process. The conscience told the tears, I know you really want me to cry, but if I release you from bondage, in gaining your freedom, you die. The tears gave it some thought before giving the conscience an answer. If crying brings you to triumph, then dying's not such a disaster. Trina Garnett was the youngest of 12 children living in the poorest section of Chester, Pennsylvania, a financially distressed municipality outside of Philadelphia. The extraordinarily high rates of poverty, crime, and unemployment in Chester intersected with the worst-ranked public school system among Pennsylvania's 501 districts. Close to 46% of the city's children were living below the federal poverty level. Trina's father, Walter Garnett, was a former boxer whose failed career had turned him into a violent, abusive, alcoholic, well known to local police for throwing a punch with little provocation. Trina's mother, Edith Garnett, was sickly after bearing so many children, some of whom were conceived during rapes by her husband. The older and sicker Edith became, the more she found herself a target of Walter's rage. He would regularly punch, kick, and verbally abuse her in front of the children. Walter would often go to extremes, stripping Edith naked and beating her until she writhed on the floor in pain while her children looked on fearfully. When she lost consciousness during the beatings, Walter would shove a stick down her throat to revive her for more abuse. Nothing was safe in the Garnett home. Trina once watched her father strangle her pet dog into silence because it wouldn't stop barking. He beat the animal to death with a hammer and threw its limp body out of a window. Trina had twin sisters, Lynn and Linda, who were a year older than her. They taught her to play invisible when she was a small child to shield her from their father when he was drunk and prowling their apartment with his belt, stripping the children naked and beating them randomly. Trina was taught to hide under the bed or in a closet and remain as quiet as possible. Trina showed signs of intellectual disabilities and other troubles at a young age. When she was a toddler, she became seriously ill after ingesting lighter fluid when she was left unattended. At the age of 5, she accidentally set herself on fire, resulting in severe burns over her chest, stomach, and back. She spent weeks in a hospital enduring painful skin grafts that left her terribly scarred. Edith died when Trina was just 9. Trina's older sisters tried to take care of her, but when Walter began sexually abusing them, they fled. After the older siblings left home, Walter's physical and sexual abuse focused on Trina, Lynn, and Linda. The girls ran away from home and began roaming the streets of Chester. Trina and her sisters would eat out of garbage cans. Sometimes they would not eat for days. They slept in parks and public bathrooms. The girls stayed with their older sister Edie until Edie's husband began sexually abusing them. Their older siblings and aunts would sometimes provide temporary shelter, but the living situation would get disrupted by violence or death, and so Trina would find herself wandering the streets again. Her mother's death, the abuse, and the desperate circumstances all exacerbated Trina's emotional and mental health problems. She would sometimes become so distraught and ill that her sisters would have to find a relative to take her to the hospital. But she was penniless and was never allowed to stay long enough to become stable or recover. Late at night in August 1976, 14-year-old Trina and her friend, 16-year-old Frances Newsom, climbed through the window of a row house in Chester. The girls wanted to talk to the boys who lived there. The mother of these boys had forbidden her children from playing with Trina, but Trina wanted to see them. Once she'd climbed into the house, Trina lit matches to find her way to the boys' room. The house caught fire. It spread quickly, and 2 boys who were sleeping in the home died from smoke asphyxiation. Their mother accused Trina of starting the fire intentionally, but Trina and her friend insisted that it was an accident.